Good evening. You're listening to 91.5 WMFO in Medford. This is Gen Z with Toasty Loaf, starting back up for the semester. First up, we've got Time by Jungle.
Yeah.
That was Rumor. I mean, sorry, The Chain from Rumors by Fleetwood Mac. And before that was Loud Places by Jamie XX. Next up, we have a podcast from the Tufts Podcast Network. It's Lit is a podcast by Jenna Fleischer, yours truly, and Shirley Wong. In this episode, we interview biological anthropology professor Zareen Machanda, who's going to read an excerpt from The Struggle for Existence, which is Chapter 3 of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Darwin's book explains how humans, doubts, anxieties, existential crises, and all, are not so different from primates. Why is this such an upsetting idea? Zareen works as a primatologist studying chimpanzees in Uganda in the Kabale National Park. She tells us there's so much about animals and ecology and plants that we have yet to understand. In one of her team's reports, they found evidence of culture in our closest primate relatives. And you can find that article on US News if you type in new evidence of culture in wild chimpanzees. So in just a minute, we'll have the podcast.
From the Tufts Podcast Network, it's Lit! Conversations with Tufts professors about a piece of literature that has moved them or has stuck with them in some way.
We see these beautiful co-adaptations most plainly in the woodpecker and mistletoe, and only a little less plainly in the humblest parasite, which clings to the hairs of a quadruped or feathers of a bird, in the structure of the beetle which dives through the water, in the plumed seed which is wafted by the gentlest breeze. In short, we see beautiful adaptations everywhere and in every part of the organic world.
That was an excerpt from The Struggle for Existence, which is Chapter 3 of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, published in 1859. Yes, that Charles Darwin, whose theory of evolution by natural selection made us realize that humans and animals are ancestrally related and that the species we know today are results of cycles of death and mutations over millions of years. Though he was not the first scientist to suggest this idea, he was the most impressionable, and mainly because of this book. Darwin was not just a biologist, he was a poet's son and a philosopher himself.
Today we'll hear anthropology professor Zareen Machanda read this chapter and tell us a little bit about her job as well as a primatologist who studies chimps in Uganda. So what do you think it was about this book that made it really popular?
So I think it was the right time for this book to come out. And I think it was also so well researched that it was, I mean, he spent 30 years kind of doing experiments and going, you know, he'd done his voyage on the Beagle. He came back. He was pretty sick when he got back, so he never went away again. But he did experiments in his garage trying to prove the theories that he was going to propose. So if you read the whole book, what it is full of experiments, just saying kind of like, here's the proof of this. But you also have to remember back in the day, this is before we had VH1 or reality TV or anything. This in many ways in Victorian England, science was entertainment. And especially among the more literate classes, I think going to scientific talks was what you did instead of going to the movies. So it was kind of more normal for these kinds of books to be written for the public, I think, than it is now today.
So when did you come across this book in your life?
Oh, wow. I think I probably first read passages from it when I was in the seventh grade, so probably when I was about 12. I have always been obsessed with the theory of evolution by natural selection. So I pretty much in high school, middle school and high school, wrote every single paper I could on evolution and natural selection. And even if it was in French class or chemistry or history, I remember my history senior project was on the Scopes monkey trial, right? So I did a whole evaluation of that. And then in my English class, I wrote a final paper on Inherit the Wind, which was the book, a play written about the Scopes monkey trial. So I think I first came across Darwin in middle school and then have just been kind of obsessed with the ideas, and it was only in college where I really kind of thought about applying some of these ideas to humans. So this is chapter 3 from On the Origin of Species. So in this, the stuff leading up to this chapter, basically Darwin had already introduced some of the basic ideas about natural selection. He had already kind of told people what the term meant, and he had already compared natural selection to domestication and artificial selection. And he actually, in fact, used the term natural selection because it was similar to artificial selection. But I wanted to pick this chapter partly so you can see how I love the chapter title is Struggle for Existence. And I think Darwin was actually quite a good writer. It's very Victorian English, so, but I think some of the writing that he has and some of the kind of analogies that he makes are just very beautifully written. Before entering on the subject of this chapter, I must make a few preliminary remarks to show how the struggle for existence bears on natural selection. It has been seen in the last chapter that amongst organic beings in a state of nature, there is some individual variability. Indeed, I am not aware that this has ever been disputed. We see these beautiful co-adaptations most plainly in the woodpecker and mistletoe, and only a little less plainly in the humblest parasite, which clings to the hairs of a quadruped or feathers of a bird, in the structure of the beetle which dives through the water, in the plumed seed which is wafted by the gentlest breeze. In short, we see beautiful adaptations everywhere and in every part of the organic world. Again, it might be asked, how is it that varieties which I have called incipient species become ultimately converted into good and distinct species, which in most cases obviously differ from each other far more than do the varieties of the same species? How do these groups of species which constitute what are called distinct genera and which differ from one another more than do the species of the same genus arise? All these results follow inevitably from the struggle for life. Owing to this struggle for life, any variation, however slight, and for whatever cause proceeding, if it be in any degree profitable to an individual of any species, in its infinitely complex relations to other organic beings and to external nature, will tend to the preservation of that individual and will generally be inherited by its offspring. The offspring also will thus have a better chance of surviving, for of the many individuals of any species which are periodically born, but a small number can survive. I have called this principle by which each slight variation, if useful, is preserved by the term of natural selection. I've seen that man by selection can certainly produce great results and can adapt organic being to his own uses through the accumulation of slight but useful variations given to him by the hand of nature. But natural selection, as we shall hereafter see, is a power incessantly ready for action, and is immeasurably superior to man's feeble efforts, as the works of nature are to those of art. Nothing is easier than to admit in the words the truth of the universal struggle for life, or more difficult, at least I have found it so, than constantly to bear this conclusion in mind. Yet unless it be so thoroughly ingrained in the mind, I am convinced that the whole economy of nature, with every fact on distribution, rarity, abundance, extinction, and variation, will be dimly seen or quite misunderstood. We behold the face of nature bright with gladness. We often see superabundance of food. We do not see, or we forget, that the birds which are idly singing round us mostly live on insects or seeds, and are thus constantly destroying life. Or we forget how largely these songsters, or their eggs, or their nestlings, are destroyed by birds and beasts of prey. We do not always bear in mind that though food may now be superabundant, it is not so at all seasons of each recurring year. I should premise that I use the term struggle for existence in a large and metaphorical sense, including dependence of one being on another, and including, which is more important, not only the life of the individual, but success in leaving progeny. Two canine animals in a time of dearth may be truly said to struggle with each other, which shall get food and live. But a plant on the edge of a desert is said to struggle for life against the drought, though more properly, it should be said to be dependent on the moisture. A plant which annually produces 1,000 seeds, of which on an average only one comes to maturity, may be truly said to struggle with the plants of the same and other kinds which already cloth the ground. The mistletoe is dependent on the apple and a few other trees, but can only in a far-fetched sense to be said to struggle with these trees. For if too many of these parasites grow on the same tree, it will languish and die. But several seedling mistletoes growing close together on the same branch may more truly be said to struggle with each other. As the mistletoe is disseminated by birds, its existence depends on birds, and it may metaphorically be said to struggle with other fruit-bearing plants in order to tempt birds to devour and thus disseminate its seeds rather than those of other plants. In these several senses, which pass into each other, I use for convenience sake the general term of struggle for existence. Every being which during its natural lifetime produces several eggs or seed must suffer destruction during some period of its life, and during some season or occasional year otherwise, or on the principle of geometrical increase, its numbers would quickly become so inordinately great that no country could support the product. Hence, as more individuals are produced than can possibly survive, there must in every case be a struggle for existence, either one individual with another of the same species, or with individuals of distinct species, or with the physical conditions of life. It is the doctrine of Malthus applied with manifold force to the whole animal and vegetable kingdoms. For in this case, there can be no artificial increase of food and no prudential restraint from marriage. Although some species may now be increasing more or less rapidly, in numbers all cannot do so, for the world would not hold them. There is no exception to the rule that every organic being naturally increases at so high a rate that if not destroyed, the earth would soon be covered by the progeny of a single pair. Even slow-breeding man has doubled in 25 years, and at this rate, in a few thousand years, there would literally not be standing room for his progeny. The elephant is reckoned to be the slowest breeder of all known animals, and I have taken some pains to estimate its probable minimal rate of natural increase. It will be under the mark to assume that it breeds when 30 years old and goes on breeding till 90 years old, bringing forth three pair of young in this interval. If this be so, at the end of the 5th century, there would be alive 15 million elephants descended from the first pair. In looking at nature, it is most necessary to keep the foregoing considerations always in mind. Never to forget that every single organic being around us may be said to be striving to the utmost to increase in numbers, that each lives by a struggle at some period of its life, that heavy destruction inevitably falls either on the young or old during each generation or at recurrent intervals. Lighten any check, mitigate the destruction ever so little, and the number of species will almost instantaneously increase to any amount. The face of nature may be compared to a yielding surface with 10,000 sharp wedges packed close together and driven inwards by incessant blows, sometimes one wedge being struck and then another with greater force. The amount of food for each species, of course, gives the extreme limit to which each can increase, but very frequently it is not the obtaining food, but the serving as prey to other animals which determines the average number of species. Thus, there seems to be little doubt that the stock of partridges, grouse, and hares on any large estate depends chiefly on the destruction of vermin. If not one head of game were shot during the next 20 years in England, and at the same time if no vermin were destroyed, there would in all probability be less game than at present, although hundreds of thousands of game animals are now annually killed. On the other hand, in some cases, as with the elephant and rhinoceros, none are destroyed by beasts of prey. Even the tiger in India most rarely dares to attack a young elephant protected by its dam. As species of the same genus have usually, though by no means invariably, some similarity in habitats and constitution, and always in structure, the struggle will generally be more severe between species of the same genus when they come into competition with each other than between species of distinct genera. We see this in recent extension over parts of the United States of one species of swallow having caused the decrease of another species. The recent increase of missel thrush in parts of Scotland has caused the decrease of the song thrush. How frequently we hear of one species of rat taking place of another species under the most different climates. In Russia, the small Asiatic cockroach has everywhere driven before its great congener. One species of charlock will supplant another, and so in other cases. We can dimly see why the competition should be most severe between allied forms, which fill nearly the same place in the economy of nature. But probably in no one case should we precisely say why one species has been victorious over another in the great battle of life. A corollary of the highest importance may be deduced from the foregoing remarks, namely that the structure of every organic being is related in the most essential yet often hidden manner to that of all other organic beings, with which it comes into competition for food or residence, or from which it has to escape, or on which it preys. It is good thus to try in our imagination to give any form some advantage over another. Probably in no single instance should we know what to do so as to succeed. It will convince us of our ignorance on the mutual relations of all organic beings, a conviction as necessary as it seems to be difficult to acquire. All we can do is keep steadily in mind that each organic being is striving to increase at a geometrical ratio, that each at some period of its life, during some season of the year, during each generation, or at intervals, has to struggle for life and to suffer great destruction. When we reflect on this struggle, we may console ourselves with a full belief that the war of nature is not incessant, that no fear is felt, that death is generally prompt, and that the vigorous, the healthy, and the happy survive and multiply.
I think as humans, we tell ourselves we have agency, we can make decisions for ourselves, we can tame nature, we can build different technologies that help us cope with environmental problems or the lack of food, right? We can work around that. But I think what he's proposing in this text is that we can't. We're just like animals, and we're susceptible to the natural struggle for existence. And ultimately, there's not a lot that we can do about that. And he's really coping with what the struggle for existence means for himself and what it means for humans. So what does it mean to define a philosophy around the lives of animals?
So I think one of the things, you mentioned that Darwin probably struggled himself. And I think one of the reasons for that is just thinking about in Victorian England, what the concept of nature actually was. And I think back then the concept of nature was one of kind of fundamental goodness. So you would go out into nature to kind of be reminded of the goodness and greatness of God and how everything lived in peace and harmony. And I think one of his struggles was that his book was really about this warfare between different individuals and between different species, and that he was worried, I think, that this negative view of nature would be really hard for people in that time period to accept. In terms of a philosophy, building a philosophy around animals and plants, I think, so as smart as humans are and as amazing as our culture is that we're able to actually go into the Antarctic and the desert, which are places that Darwin thought no one could ever live, we actually can go there and figure out a way to live there. But there are lots of catastrophes that nature presents to us that we haven't been able to use technology to solve. And, I think in hundreds of years, we will reach that point where we have increased geometrically to the point where there is no more space for us. And yet we might beat a lot of species to do that. And we have been. We have been beating a lot of species. We have been wiping them out completely. And that's not that, that goes with what Darwin's saying, right? That sometimes you're going to get species who can just wipe other species out. We happen to be one of them. But we will also reach a point where we can't do that anymore. The other thing that Darwin talked about in this chapter was kind of this web of life that we don't understand. We don't understand all of the complexities. Animals and plants have all of these complex connections with each other that we can't figure out. And so I think one of the things that will happen is that we'll get to this point where we realize, oh, crap, you mean we needed forests to have water? What?
I think that Darwin, like, when he's trying to give us moments of solace or, like, help us come to terms with this reality, he just says, like, death is prompt, which isn't really that helpful to some people. I mean, it can be for some others. But how would you explain this to kids, you know, like, mm-hmm. who are just learning about this?
I think what Darwin did and what theories of evolution in general do is they, in many ways, strip what's special about humans, right? I mean, if we think of ourselves as divine beings or a special creation, mm-hmm. you know, once Galileo took us from being the center of the universe, which was, a big problem, then you have Darwin come along and say, not only are we not the center of the universe and we don't live in these perfect concentric circles around, you know, the sun doesn't revolve around us, now we're not even different from the other animals and plants that live on the earth. We are just part of the same struggle for existence that they are. I think all of us who teach evolutionary biology are kind of working on that. I mean, I give school talks all the time from Massachusetts to Ohio to Texas, and certainly come across a lot of people who are very against accepting the theory by natural selection. I mean, to me, it's not something that I believe in. I mean, it's like people ask you, like, oh, you believe in evolution, as if I have to have faith in order to believe in it. And I don't believe in evolution. I know that it happens. And I know that's kind of I'm drawing a line in the sand here. But it's not about belief for me, because I have read, there's so much overwhelming evidence that this is the process by which, you know, nature, like, this is the process of nature. You know, I think the reason that I like this field is that I'm really okay with not knowing the answer to something.
Okay.
Like, there are things that I know I will never know about chimps, mm-hmm. because they don't speak. We can't get them to speak right now. I don't think we ever will. I think a lot of people are not as okay with that. I think people want answers. And I think in the absence of answers, you might get things like God filling in, or you might get religion filling in. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that is dependent on who you are, right? I think if you are someone who strives answers and doesn't like not knowing something, if that fulfills you, I think that's really important. If that's what makes you happy and fulfilled and a good person, I think that's fine. That's not how I am, and I think that's fine too.
I think of connecting to other animals as just like a practice of compassion and, but yeah, I know. Yeah. And not like empathizing, because there's not really a way to do that. But I mean, for me, when I practice trying to understand animals, it also helps me figure out what the tools are to understanding like another person. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would use the word compassion. I mean, I have this curiosity about animals that I've had since I was a kid. Just, I just want to know what they're doing and why they're doing it and how they're doing it. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a really like scientific endeavor, mm-hmm. I think, my connection to animals. But I mean, for me, it's also a practical cataloging of, you know, this species that I study that is endangered, that will likely go extinct. So for me, it's also this endeavor to try to catalog nature before we lose the ability to do it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm one of the people on Earth who's tasked with creating this catalog of chimp behavior, trying to understand why and how. I think they're an important species for us to understand humans, but they are going to go extinct. And they're not going to be able to face the struggle against us, right? They're not going to win that struggle. And so for me, there's this practicality to it, that I have this limited amount of time, not just in my life, but for chimps on Earth, where I'm tasked with doing that.
Okay, well, thank you so
much. Yeah, thank you. This gives me an opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Great.
That was episode 5 of It's Lit with Zareen Machanda, a professor of biological anthropology here at Tufts. If you want to hear more episodes, you can go to TuftsPodcastNetwork.com. Next week, we'll be playing episode... I think we skipped episode 4, so we'll go back to that one and play that. Again, that's TuftsPodcastNetwork.com. And so we'll do a quick PSA, and then we'll be back with more music, so stay tuned.
Hey, America, we need to have a little talk. We've got more food in our country than we know what to do with. Food at the grocery store and food in the vending machines, fast food, health food, and seafood. We've got so much food that anything people don't buy, we just throw out. Yet 17 million kids in America struggle with hunger. That ain't right. Luckily, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks has volunteers gathering excess food and getting it to hungry kids. They're kind of like food angels. Yeah, I made that up. It's kind of catchy. Hello, people. This isn't rocket science. We could solve hunger today. To start, become a food angel yourself by supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. That's a website. Duh. We can't do it without your help. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
As we spin around in circles, laughing, only seeing the planets painted on the walls. As you look upon them, you realize there's no need to pretend. These people can make you feel happy again. We're still at the age of driving, feels like flying. I never knew I could feel so free by the pavement. But the only thing that we have in common is a my time.
was Fire from Justice's relatively new album, Woman. And before that was Common Fear by Moonrise Nation, a band from Chicago whose lead singer I went to high school with. So pretty cool. The time is now 6:48, so winding down and almost the end of the hour. Thanks for tuning in to the first episode of Toasty Loaf for this fall semester. I'll be here every week, Tuesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
Michelangelo, something about the juice you wear. Shiny, shiny bangers on your wrists. And at the masquerade ball, you're trapped in a vault and an empty aquarium. Suddenly you're out of the woods. Inside of an alley, you're out of words. When I thought it was radium at first.
Every night I live and die, feel the power. party to my bones. Watch the wasters blow the speakers. Spill my guts beneath the outdoor light. It's just another graceless night. I hate the headlines and the weather. I'm 19 and I'm on fire. But when we're dancing, I'm alright. It's just another graceless night. Are you lost enough? Have another drink, get lost in us. This is how we get notorious. Cause I don't know if they keep telling me where to go. I'll blow my brains out to the radio. And I meet somebody, take them home. Let's kiss and then take off our clothes. It's just another graceless night. Find these perfect places. What the fuck are perfect places anyway?
That was Perfect Places by Lord. This has been Toasty Loaf with me, DJ Gen Z. Next up is Live Free or Die, so stay tuned.
Won't listen to the words I decide on.